Waiting for my cue there, as you could see. I didn't know it was going to be sung in English as well. Or perhaps you expect my Maltese now is up to snuff. But not really, apart from bonjour and ciao ciao. It's nice to see you again. A number of people have said I brought the weather. I can assure you I did not. So I'm quite surprised to see this, but we'll deal with it, you know. Maybe the skies are a little tearful because of the theme of Holy Week. Anyway, I'll start with something, without wishing to stereotype, but with something for the ladies. I have a younger sister, a strong feminist and an academic, who keeps me in my place on a regular basis, as you can imagine. And she occasionally goes off also on, you know, ventures like this to talk in different places. You know, and she sets out her wardrobe for the 3 days and all is very, you know, well prepared. And she says she has to do that because her lady colleagues in particular would have a heart attack if she wore the same thing 3 days in a row. Well, that's exactly what I had intended to do. Except by some inspiration last night, I said I'd come with the green shirt tonight. Shoots of resurrection. So I did. So all is not lost. We spoke yesterday. We have difficult themes this week because it is, you know, a week in which in the liturgy we recall the events of the life of Jesus that are not joyful events. And of course, I love to avoid pain, But we can't do that. So we have had to face the sacrifice of the cross, the suffering of Jesus, the death of Jesus. And but always when we do, and that's why I called the talks Approaching Easter in Troubled Times, that the times are troubled, and there is always death and always suffering, but of course there is resurrection as well. We have a Christian hope of that, which isn't a naive optimism. Yesterday, speaking about sacrifice, I think the basic point I was making was that I talked a lot about love before speaking specifically of sacrifice, because it's love that makes sense of sacrifice. In your own lives, you make many sacrifices, and you often do it cheerfully, even if you find it difficult, because you do it from love. And so yesterday we stayed with the sacrifice of the cross, in which Jesus gave everything, both to save us from our sins, but also to be in solidarity with all people, especially those who suffer innocently. And to some extent, that is all of us. So he hangs there and waits for us there. At the end yesterday, we had come to the point of admitting that the conundrum of innocent suffering and the justice of God is one that we're always faced with. Most people I meet in pastoral situations, and it's true in my own life too, find it hardest of all to square that God is loving and just with the tragedies and the difficulties that people run into in life. Now, that's not a question or a matter that can ever be fully solved, but I thought that I should, just before finishing entirely with suffering, say a little bit more about that tonight, just one approach to it. And then after that, say something about death, but not too negatively. And after that, allow, with the green shirt, an approach to the glimmers of resurrection. So, for once, I'm structured in 3 points. And the good thing about knowing that is that you'll know as I go through each one, I'll tell you, you'll know you're getting close to the end. A question, then, that faces all Christian believers is, you know, in the face of the Southeast Asian tsunami, you know, about 7 years ago, I think it was, or the earthquake in Haiti, followed by a second one, or the floods in Bangladesh, not to mention also the illnesses that befall good people out of the blue. When you see these things and you see the amount of suffering that is there, you say to yourself, how can we square that with our belief in a good, a loving, and a provident God? God seems to be absent, or at best, he seems to be asleep while good people suffer. In the past, people in my profession, people who taught theology or who were priests, were too defensive of God and tried to answer this question perhaps in too easy a way. They often tried to come up with a theory of everything that explained how somehow it was all right, but actually most people's experience was screaming at them, it's not all right, please don't give me those kinds of answers. I prefer you sit with me and say nothing than you try to explain to me what it's impossible to understand. So we try not to do that so much anymore, and we have become a little more reticent and more humble about this question. A good example is a writer that many of you would know, C.S. Lewis, the famous Shadowlands man. Well, when C.S. Lewis was young, he was a good fellow and a smart one too, but he wrote a book called The Problem of Pain, and he referred to pain as God's megaphone, that when you have severe pain, when something strikes that brings you up short and makes you reflect and so on, that it's God screaming at you, and it might be an invitation to turn around and to change things. Well, it's well and good and true that sometimes a disaster in our lives can have such an effect. But the problem would be, wouldn't it, suggesting that God sends it so that it would have such an effect. That kind of image of God is very odd. What parent would bring their children forward by perpetrating disaster on them first? So it was when Lewis was older, he had married late in life. He married a woman called Joy, and when he was young, he had written a book called Surprised by Joy. So that was a nice providential occurrence. But when she died of harrowing cancer, he was broken-hearted. And then he said he understood how useless his first book was. Because he said, I called on this God to whom I had always been faithful. I shouted at him. I called out to him. I asked him why. And he said, what did I get? Silence. A door slammed in my face, locked and double bolted. Wham! And that, of course, is the experience of a maturer man who, when he was in trouble, couldn't write in the same way and defend God in the same nice, neat way as he could when the problems belonged to somebody else. So Lewis's book is a wonderful book called A Grief Observed, well worth a read, but it really taught him the isolation of suffering and that sense that many of you probably know from such situations, that precisely in moments of grief, you feel that heaven is closed against you. This is not something that is absent from the scriptures. For example, Job. Certainly from reading Job, you can see that he had something of this experience. It was grand with God. We say grand in Ireland quite a lot for things. But then the troubles came. But Job, of course, as you know, shouted back. The Psalms also recount, don't they, how people really feel. There are wonderful images. The waters are to my throat. Fierce bulls of Bashan surround me. How long, O Lord, how long? At least these prayers are truthful, aren't they? They're not trying to make out everything is fine and exonerate God for situations that you can't explain. And of course, no one more clearly than Jesus. In the garden in Gethsemane, all his friends fell asleep, and from his Father there appeared to be nothing but silence. The only thing you can say when you're in such a situation and the terrifying question comes, God, where are you? Are you there at all? The only thing that you can do is say that as with Job, and so with Jesus, and so with all those pious prayers of the Psalms, at least I can place my story beside their story and hope that as God vindicated them, that my day will come also. To ally today's horrendous stories with the stories of the great sufferers of history who somehow kept their faith in God is not to provide a rational explanation for suffering, but it is to provide some kind of path in terms of what to do when the situation is really difficult. When confronted with difficult suffering, a place to go can be the great religious traditions of humanity, not just Christianity, but also the others. Buddhism, for example, has deep wisdom about suffering. Because in those places, you will find teachers who at least help you to keep going. They're not, I regret to say, the priests, the theologians, and the philosophers. The big teachers in this area are the sufferers. The people who, because they have somehow managed themselves in a way that can't be explained, to maintain a relationship with God and some sense of future, they're the ones who instruct us best. Isn't it true, and I have actually seen this, people, for example, who are, say, suffering from an illness that requires that they go periodically to hospital for treatment, frequently make friends with others whom they meet there who are experiencing the same treatment. And at least in understanding each other, they're putting their stories together and finding some sense of meaning. Often this is quite helpful. Now, my understanding would be, I spoke to you about increments or snippets of salvation, that right there, in the help that one person gives another, there is also the touch of the Lord and the presence of his companionship. In the Bible, above all, two books deal with this question of innocent suffering. One is Job, as you know, and the other is the book of Revelation, very complicated at the end of the New Testament, but it has something to say about this question too. Job was not content with the arid and earless thought of his lofty comforters, if you like, the clerics of his time, or the knowledgeable ones who could tell Job what was happening while they were in suffering. So he claimed the right to tell it as it was, and to do so loudly and at length. If you read the whole book of Job, it's about 42 chapters. 37 of them are Job giving God a piece of his mind. And he certainly does. His journey of lament and of protest and complaint, he who was a just man and who lost everything, this journey in which he managed to stay in relationship with God while continuing to complain, came to the point of being able to admit that he couldn't understand everything. And he stayed connected. Job calls God terrible things: a hunter, a spy, a sadist. And towards the end of the book of Job, he is commended by God for, and this is meant to be the voice of God, for speaking of me what is right. The book of Job gives us the freedom to shake the fist at God, to speak at him, as I said yesterday, out of the kitchens of our lives, to tell him we don't like it, we don't understand it, we want an explanation, to protest and relate like people do who care about one another. So any authentic story of real suffering will include protest and lament, and eventually perhaps the learned wisdom received as a gift that not everything can be comprehended. Job was lucky enough to be able to remain in relationship with the Lord, but not because he avoided the questions, precisely because he entered into them. Just like the incomprehension with which Job is left, even after such a journey, as we said yesterday, Christ on the cross is incomprehensible too. There is a folly to the cross, a scandal, an inexplicability. And nevertheless, the Christian can't approach terrible suffering without remembering the words of St. Paul, that God's weakness is stronger than human strength. That is what the cross proclaims. There is paradox there. The book of Revelation that I said to you is the book in the New Testament that deals most with the question of innocent suffering, actually says that God governs the world not by power, but by vulnerability. In other words, God governs not by externally imposed might from above, but by a kind of undefended power from within the world's suffering. And in this way, as the letter to the Hebrews says, God is God with us. He's God with us in everything, including horrendous tragedies. This picture of God, of course, is quite different to the picture of God that we might have acquired naively as children. God is no celestial Superman. He doesn't zoom into the world, troubleshooting from on high, to reboot our flawed planet. God makes things be, and in making things be, he includes letting things be. But of course not unconcernedly. Imagine if God were not to let created things be what they are, have the autonomy that they have, but if instead God always ensured that nothing in the created world could possibly go wrong, then we would end up with nothing in this world being of any value, because of course it would be all pre-programmed. We would have a world, it would still be a world, but it would no longer be this world. I seem to remember, it's not in my text, it just comes to my mind. Do you remember Brave New World, the novel that was written many years ago? But it was predicated upon the idea that people would be all right if they had what they wanted and wanted what they had. The idea was to kind of cap off their desires, to give them what they needed, and they would need what they were given. And so Bob's your uncle, you'd have an equilibrated world. And there is a text somewhere in that book, and I'm sorry I didn't think to bring it with me, but somebody says, "Give me a cry of pain. Give me one shout of suffering. Give me, you know," in other words, "let me feel again. Let me know the pain of love, the joy of ecstasy, the involvement in real relationship, but don't make it be bland and monochrome. I can't remember more of that from the text now, but I think that if we want a pre-programmed world where when the water is falling upon me to engulf me, gravity will somehow be reverted by God and send it in the other direction, and so on and so forth. And similarly, I'll make choices, but if they were ever to hurt another person, somehow God will intervene and nullify them. That would be great in a way. There wouldn't be any tragedies, betrayals, accidents, etc. But it wouldn't be our world. It wouldn't be this world. It probably wouldn't be the world of love and pathos and pain and joy and agony and ecstasy that is pretty darn difficult to live in, but that is not entirely without its beauty. The image of God and God's relationship with the world that comes from the two scenarios that I've described, the vulnerable Jesus in solitary suffering with all who suffer innocently on the one hand, but God healing from within and to some extent disempowered from without, versus the picture of the ever-intervening God who in his interventions nullifies and destroys the world as we know it. These two contrasting pictures make the second sound like God would be more efficient, but I think, despite all, I find the first more consoling. The picture in which God mysteriously suffers with us, beside us, as well as us, like us in Jesus. A God who goes to the depths of human suffering, indeed into the depths of death itself, into the place of non-being. And to do that, he does that in order to bring out of those places what we can never fully comprehend: new life, resurrection, joy. So in the brief time that remains with us, we will reflect perhaps a little just on the dead Christ of Holy Saturday and on death, and on the risen one of Easter Sunday at the end, without my being able to say anything like what would be sufficient. The thing about the resurrection is this. It's what I call in my theology classes an underivable. I love what you can derive. I liked sums, derived formulas, things that come from previous things, that lead on, that you can understand. And there's much that you can understand in theology and faith too. But the resurrection is a surprise. Wasn't Paul's great difficulty in 1 Corinthians 15:3 and following, his great difficulty in talking about the resurrection was to get people to take on board that this Jesus who had died was really and truly alive. That was not a fabricated myth. That was a surprise for everyone. Even those Jews who believed in resurrection, believed in general resurrection, but not in individual resurrection. So what happened to Jesus would also have been opaque to their understanding. I always like to have an explanation, but I have no explanation for the resurrection. It is the ground of our hope. We have it in our stumbling faith, and it is the gratuitous action of God in the face of the fate that is ours through suffering and death. So let's look a little at death and a little at resurrection, but without ever hoping to comprehend resurrection, but perhaps hoping to say yes to it gratefully. Joseph Ratzinger, a theologian whom you've all read, heard certainly, know, he said once that a religion stands or falls on what it has to say about death, because death is the great question of life. I mentioned this already. Life is the business of learning to die. I will never climb Kilimanjaro. I once had aspirations. I will never master the Hebrew language really well, or the Maltese. I might have had aspirations. I will never run a marathon. my cardiologist doesn't recommend it. You know what I mean? There are things that don't come back this time round because time marches on. There is a finitude to our lives, and we learn to die and let go day by day. Through the first Adam, sin came into the world. Through the second Adam, thank God, forgiveness, new life, resurrection came into the world. So God responded, and he also, I was never denying this with my other emphases in the past 3 days, he also healed what we broke. There is a lovely picture, again by that German theologian that you've all been reading, at least for the last 7 years, and probably never before that. It's a lovely picture of his understanding of immortality, the gift we are given as Christians, as human beings. He says that it's based on dialogue, that when God creates a human being, the human being enters God's memory. And so the human being can never die, because God's memory can never fail. What happens in creation that God begins a conversation with God's creature? We might forget, lose our thread in the conversation, lose our minds, but God, whose memory is infallible, can never forget the conversation he has begun with us. And so we live forever, because God is our conversation partner, and the dialogue must therefore be eternal. In other words, Ratzinger wanted to talk about the soul, but not in an abstract and disembodied kind of way, rather in a relational and non-substantialist kind of way. So he said, think of the fact that you are related in that way to your Creator, and because the dialogue with him is eternal, you live forever. Other theologians thinking about death have made Christ, and rightly, the center of the picture. He went into death in order to bring us out of death. As Christians now, baptized into the life of Christ, and you know that the baptismal imagery itself is of dying and rising, Christians already share in the pattern of his life, death, and resurrection. So you can say that for all our imperfections, by the grace of God, we live in Christ now. When we die into Christ. Theologians more and more would say now, that relationship which we carry with us from life already, with the spark of eternity, because it's a relationship with Christ, continues through death, where we hold his hand as we walk into the unknown. And then at the end of history, when things will be completed and God will be all in all, we have been told of Christ's second coming. So here again you see that he is the center, and all of history will be transformed, our resurrection will be completed, the matter of the world itself will be saved, and once again the center of Christian hope is Christ making all things new. An idea I came across recently, which I found quite helpful, was this. We all learnt in school that God created the world out of nothing. Creatio ex nihilo, you remember? I didn't learn in school, and actually till quite late on, I didn't learn to think that the new creation is creatio ex vetere, namely, out of the old creation. This is quite a nice idea. It means that God is not disinterested in all that he has made, but rather all that God has created becomes the basis for all that God will recreate. When we say, therefore, we believe in the resurrection of the body, that includes things like not only our own full identity. Aquinas once said that my soul is not myself. So if my body isn't raised, then the whole of me is not raised. So not only is it true that our bodies are redeemed, but also, insofar as these refer to our stories in history, our relationships, our connectedness to other people, all the things that we have done and been involved in, all of this is gathered into the embrace of God in Christ at the end of time. And the resurrection of the body means that we can look forward to an entire renewed creation. It's important when we speak of salvation to know that it has real content, that it is forgiveness of sins, resurrection of the body, the communion of saints, life everlasting, and a new creation. There's a lot there, all one through the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. To speak now a little bit about death in ways that we know more about it. I know you know about it in terms of all the losses that you go through daily, taking half an hour to get out of an armchair. I went to visit my sister and it took 4 hours to get there. When I got out of the car, I was going, and I said very self-centeredly, you know, oh, I wonder, do I have arthritis or something? And she said, no, Jim, and she's 11 years younger than I am, you're 56. As I was at the time. Things don't spring back the same way they did when you're... None of you young people understand what I'm talking about, and all of you with hair my color know exactly what I'm talking about. The elastic just doesn't work. And so it goes. Well, I wanted to talk about death from another angle for a minute, an angle from which you've also experienced it, and the sadness of it, namely the angle of bereavement. We've all lost people we love. And we wonder sometimes, where are they now? We have good days and we have bad days. We already spoke of C.S. Lewis, the pain he went through, and that's often the case immediately after a bereavement. Somebody once, a counselor who was helping me with the bereavement, he said to me, your life is like, it's a chessboard. All the pieces are one color and all the squares are occupied. There's gridlock and you feel you can't move. You go here, you go there, you do this, you do that, but you're stymied. This blank wall of death, of loss, is staring you in the face. You feel emptiness at the loss of somebody who has been there for so long. St. Augustine, like all the saints, had quite a robust relationship with God, and on one occasion, he lost a friend that had been a school friend. Then he had lost that friendship during life, but got it back a few years before this man then suddenly died. And Augustine was very sad, and he found himself praying, and he thought he heard the voice of God say, well, Augustine, you always have me. To which Augustine flashed back as quick as he could, yeah, you, but you I can see, him I could see. I like prayers like this. I can relate to them, they make sense to me. There's a story by Chekhov, some of you might know it. I'll probably tell it somewhat wrongly because I remember reading it about 30 years ago. So whether what I'm saying is the story or the impression the story made on me, it's for those of you who are literary scholars to correct me afterwards. But what I remember is this. There was a cabbie, a guy who used to drive a horse-drawn taxi, as it were, you know, in the snowy city, some snowy city of Russia. And it was winter. And this man's son had just died. And as his various passengers got in, or his fares, as they were called, one after another, in the blizzard, which he was taking them through their destinations, he would try to say something about his son, to engage them in conversation, in his isolation and loneliness. But in that freezing climate, every one of them froze him out. On you go, cabby. Don't be slow. We need to get home. Get us there. So one by one, they ignored his story. I suppose that's vintage Chekhov, that we're all somehow running around desperate to make connections, and mostly we're just bypassing each other. I was moved in the story that time, before I had ever known bereavement, of the loneliness of the man and how he ended up telling his horse. That's the way the story finished. Many years later, after my own mother had died, she was a person who was full of devilment, a twinkle in her eye, last to leave a party, at 1 o'clock in the morning would say, why are we going home now? When she was in her 70s. Well, eventually anyway, she did go to heaven, and it was all okay. You know, she had lived a good life, my 5 siblings were happy, you know, that she was at peace and all that. Except one morning I went down my local street, I got terribly annoyed. There were people going into the sandwich shop to buy their coffee on the way to work. There were boys and girls loitering on the street on the way to school. Buses were rolling by. Taxis were blowing their horns. And life had the audacity to go on in all its general behavior. And I was affronted because somebody had left the planet and they didn't give the slightest. You know what I mean? Now, that was me that day. But for everybody who loses somebody close, there's something desperately affronting about the world that goes on in its quotidian repetitive patterns. It has to do that, of course, but there's something about it that leaves you feeling isolated. And these things I know you know, and these things are associated with death, death that we don't experience directly, but because of the loss that it is, we experience quite profoundly. A Canadian writer, Carol Shields, a feminist, a university professor, I think, and also a novelist, she wrote a short story called Dying for Love. The story has three small vignettes. They tell the stories of three different women who have been betrayed in love. The bad guys are the men, and the women are left there with the wall in front of them, as it were. It's interesting that in each case, although each contemplates ending her life, they find something, some thread, some minuscule reason to somehow still opt into life rather than opt out of it. She refers to this something that they find, that they probably didn't even know was in them, by using the word handrail. That they find a handrail, and by means of the handrail, they hold themselves upright and somehow still move on. They do not choose death. They manage to choose life. When I was a young student in Germany, we used to go to the Dolomites sometimes. And you know the way those mountains, the stones come straight up. They're limestone, I think. And they kind of come straight, they shoot straight up into the sky. The Asterix and Obelix. You know, these, these mountains, but they sometimes have handrails built into them. And as you go up, there's often swirling cloud. And all you have to hold is the handrail. You can't see the next step. You go up in trust, but you just hope that the person who put the handrail in the rock was good at their job. Life can be like that sometimes. You know Newman's prayer, I do not ask to see the distant scene, one step enough for me. Sometimes that's all that there is. But it's astounding how many people move forward, holding the handrail, to take that next foggy step. For the women in the story, it was like what I called grace yesterday. Enough to save them, enough to suggest the possibility of continued existence, and perhaps even around the corner, something like resurrection and new life. One final example. A colleague I have, she was teaching one day in class shortly after the death of her father. She was very close to her father, and she found his death very difficult. She had no energy. She wasn't interested in what she was doing. There was that lifelessness that comes sometimes with bereavement. And she told me, and she holds no brief much for faith or church, and certainly not for sensational stories. But she told me she became quite certain of the presence of her father in the room. Pragmatically, encouragingly, but more or less saying to her, Susan, get on with it. I'm fine, really. The last thing I'd want is that your engine would start spluttering. Do what you do. Be who you are. And she said from that inexplicable experience, she couldn't really figure out what had happened, but she was quite certain that something did. The darkness was never as bad after that, and she was able to resume her life, and in due course, even to enjoy it again. I've been doing with these stories the same things as I've been doing with you the other nights, haven't I? I've been inviting you to become detectives of resurrection. Last night I invited you to become a detective of salvation, God's healing action in the world. And the previous night, I think I said something about being a detective of grace, which is the hidden presence of God in the world, but made manifest through created things. 'Tis a great service that Christians could provide for the world, and humbly too, because it involves as much not seeing as seeing. if we were able to say to people, look, there might be a trace of God's presence there. That might be a footprint. Look again. It's exciting to be a detective of grace, to be a detective of resurrection, to be a detective of new life. And I think we are called in this liturgical week too, beyond the pain of Easter, without avoiding it, oh yes, going through it, to be witnesses to the resurrection, just like Mary and Peter and John and the other disciples were. They knew all the disappointment of the bereavement, and they knew all the new life, having opened themselves up to the possibility that it was true. When people have gone before us, it can be difficult to imagine where they are. We were taught when we were kids to pray to the saints, but I wasn't always that mad about the saints, because they were saints. They were much more distant from me and their behavior, as depicted, than they were close to me. However, it was easier to think of people that I had known, who had shared the same circumstances as I did. My grandmother was a saint, for example, not of the official kind, and she loved me ridiculously. No matter what I did, she found a reason to explain and justify it. But when she died, you could still remember her in the kitchen. You could still remember her out in the garden with the hens that she kept. So it was more possible to imagine somehow that she was still alive. And I found that as I got older, sometimes when people died, and I was dealing, for example, as a teacher, with their difficult children, this might be one for you, I used to talk to the parents who had gone and say, what am I to do with them? Somehow that makes the saints more visible, doesn't it? It brings them closer. Karl Rahner, great German theologian, his point was, start with them, and then you might get some sense of the communion of saints, of all together enjoying eternal blessedness. The old French Dominican, Yves Congar, he was asked once, did he get great consolation from praying together with the members of his community at home? Now the Jesuits present will laugh. Sometimes we don't get as much consolation from the presence of the brethren as we might like. One of them might be snoring during prayer and another grunting. But this man answered, he said, oh, not just from the brethren, but from memory of those who have gone before. And he also began to mention Christians of other denominations, and indeed non-Christians. He said, all of them give me a leg up. They are a factor in my prayer. We are made for one another. So my prayer involves, he said, the whole communion of saints, Augustine and Basil and Julian of Norwich, also Abraham and David and Moses. I am indebted to them. They give me help. As I said, death we know, resurrection we just catch glimpses of. Resurrection is underivable. It is the gift given by God. It can't be concluded from finite biological life. It is God doing a new thing. In the preface of Christian death at Mass that we hear, we speak about the sadness of death being changed to the bright promise of immortality. We speak of life changed, not ended. These, of course, are things we say in faith. But it's not ridiculous to say them. They have been said for 2,000 years. The disciples who hung around with Jesus, abstaining from conversation about the women, who were all faithful, but the men were a bunch of cowards, isn't that right? But all of them, whatever happened to convince them that he whom they had seen die was now alive, all of them got energy, wings to their feet, courage where there had been cowardice. The resurrection itself is a difficult event to penetrate, but it is a historical fact that these rather difficult, shallow, cowardly men became people willing to preach Jesus from one end of the earth to the other, and to do so without fear of losing their lives. And indeed, they did lose their lives for what they believed. So we can rely on them and we can hope that what they hoped is really true. So we can approach Easter in these troubled times without fear, with realism to be sure, but with hope. What time is it? Is it 5 to? Can I keep you a couple more minutes? I have three snippets without which this wouldn't be complete. I mean, I'm always amazed that the time goes so fast. You know, the whole business about being detectives of resurrection, I think that's really quite important because it makes us as Christians outward looking. And I'll just give you three small examples. I spent a couple of years in Worcester, Massachusetts. It's a real backwater, but it has a magnificent art gallery. They must have got a lot of money from somebody and they bought up paintings. But they have an El Greco, and it's an elongated figure, typical of El Greco paintings, you know, but not at all depressing, with dark clouds and lots of purple. It's mostly blue, with actually the clouds clearing to white, and you see in the corner of the painting a magnificent white sky. The figure painted is, he calls it, the repentant Magdalene. And she is there, and she has a tear lodged on a rather ample cheek, almost like a jewel. And he manages somehow to capture in her face pain, incredulity, and absolute astonishment. It is the most beautiful example of what must be the case when a person moves from being a sinner, to knowing that they are loved, to knowing that this has been done for them, to knowing that he is alive, and that she can be alive with him, and to knowing that the future is one of hope. I never look at that painting without coming away and really feeling that I have received something. So sometimes through art, you'll catch the glimpse. Beauty is one pathway to God. Another small example that I remember from a few years ago, I went to Nigeria, and I visited certainly the Nazareth of Nigeria. In the poorest state, the poorest village, I have a friend who's Irish. She's the prioress of a Carmelite monastery there, of enclosed women. I spent a month there living with 13 women, in a separate house, of course, all very correct. But they knew everything. When I went out at night, the dogs barked when I came in, even though I only went out with the priest for a few beers. They'd say the next day, "Oh, Father, you came home rather late. Did you have a nice night?" But while I was there, on Sundays, the families used to come for Mass. And this family came, and they had a little girl. She was about 11, not very well grown, because, of course, quite undernourished and all that. Very poor. But she was as bright as a button. She was stunningly intelligent. And she was about to end school. That's bad. It's bad anywhere. It's typical of Nigeria, and it's trebly typical for a girl. She had a mind full of curiosity, and she was full of life. Anyway, we found, by a kind of conspiracy of care, of which I was lucky to be a small part, we found a European donor who was willing to fund her to go to a school in a nearby city run by the Augustinians, who are also present in the parish. And when she got there, she was really happy. She was 117th in a class of 135 when she came home the first Christmas, but she was determined to do better, not competitively, but because she was a feisty and self-confident little girl. Now she's up near the top of the class, halfway through secondary school, on the generosity of this person. So here I give you an example of justice and love, transforming a situation of injustice. It would have been an injustice, and there are so many of them, if she didn't get the chance to simply develop the gifts that were in her. I'd call that another snippet of resurrection, and certainly watch out for her. The final one, I have to read this because it had to be formulated carefully. It's about Germany. A final snippet of resurrection comes to me in the memory of a well-timed Easter Mass in the German parish church where I lived as a student. With a precision only possible in Germany, the morning sun, unlike what we hear outside, by the way, the morning sun creeping stealthily up the church building on the outside splashed through a side window to send a shaft of light across the nave before our stunned eyes, just at the moment when the choir was thundering, and he rose. Everybody in the congregation gasped as the beam of light suggested the new life of Christ springing from his tomb, rising with the dawn of that new day to spread his light and to scatter the surrounding darkness. We need that light in our troubled times, that hope, that snippet of resurrection. We need it now. And I am sure that the Lord will not withhold it from you, from us, this Easter 2012. This is my fervent hope, and it's my prayer for you all. Thank you.
Thank you. So we come to a close to these 3 days of inspiring, profound thoughts. So thank you very much, Father Jim, for being with us, for preparing each and every one of us to enter the Holy Triduum with great expectations, being detectives for the signs. I'm sure we'll do our best to be faithful to our role as detectives. I'd like to obviously inform you that tomorrow our service will begin at 7 p.m., followed by the Altar of Repose, where Father Arthur Vella will lead the first hour as a holy meditation in front of the Blessed Sacrament. The Altar of Repose will remain open till midnight and then reopen in the morning at 7 till around 11:45, where you are very welcome to come and spend some time with the Lord. The 3 o'clock function then will commence, obviously, at the Adoration of the Cross. For those of you who would like, after the 3 o'clock function, we will have a guided Way of the Cross, and everybody is welcome to join for that. It is being prepared by a group of students who will take care of guiding you step by step. Then the wonderful Ray of Hope reaches us on Saturday night, and that function starts at 8 p.m., where we can truly together live the resurrection and receive the great hope. But before we close, we have something special for you, Father Jim, and that is an Irish blessing. Thank you very, very, very much. You thought it would be a Maltese blessing, but we wanted to make you feel at home, so thank you. So with that blessing, we thank you very much for your inspiring words and for being with us. For those of you who would like to re-listen to the talks we had on Monday, Tuesday and today, they will be up on the Campus FM website. I believe that the first talk is already available online. If you'd like to listen to them, you can check the program out on their website on Campus FM, but you can also download them and have them at home and listen to them when you'd like to. So thank you very much, and thank you to Andrew and his family for animating the three nights for us. So thank you. God bless you all.